Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. I'm happy because we have Seth here. I miss Seth so much. I'm so happy.
What am I doing here? I'm not an ex-Muslim. You know,
You're an honorary ex-Muslim. We have honorarily inducted you. We made you a Muslim and then made you leave it.
I'm glad to be here. This is one of those really refreshing forums where I can actually be overtly critical of Islam. And the first thing you say to me in return is not Islamophobe, because that's usually what happens to me. You know, when I'm talking about the idea, the truth claims of Islam, and they're like, well, you just hate Muslims. And I'm like, no, I'm criticizing Islam because I care about Muslims. You know, it's a whole other show. But no, it's good.
Wait, that still happens? That still happens? Like, even the whole you're a bigot Islam. I thought we have made a. Oh, really?
More than ever. Yes. I haven't seen it quite as much in the last few months, but I still see it. People are still walking softly around Islam. Not to digress too much, but I just saw a documentary, an HBO documentary called Welcome to Chechnya. And it was talking about how the Chechenian government is actually rounding up LGBT people and torturing and executing them. Hmm. And so there's an organization that's going in and trying to whisk them out of the country to save their lives. And this hour plus documentary talks about the persecution of these LGBT people, but not once do they mention that the excuse that they are using is Islam. Wow. They said it's a Muslim majority country, but they didn't actually get to some of the root of the problem. And I was just screaming at the television, like, you know, we have a responsibility to be truthful and to criticize the basic tenets of this bigoted faith. So anyway, forgive the digression, but I wanted to throw that out.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's that much of a digression. I think what's become a little tougher with the whole Islam thing is that, at least I've seen, is that the way that we used to criticize it in the past, now when you do it, you're lumped in with these sort of alt-right, anti-Muslim type people, and that makes the conversation a little bit more difficult. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do. But I was going to actually, what we're here to talk about, and we'll talk about this too, is I love your new book. And I'm saying that even though I haven't finished it all, so maybe something will pop up and I'll be like, oh my God, this is the worst book ever. But so far, so far, I've been reading it. And I think that this is the best book you've written. It's very, very relevant. So the book, I'm going to just tell everybody this really quick before we go into it. The book is called Confessions of a Fox News Christian. And Seth, for those of you who don't know, I don't know how many, probably a tiny minority of you, Seth was once a fundamentalist Christian. He was a Christian radio host, conservative radio host. Today, you know, he's a secular humanist and he's a very well-known atheist activist. And your book actually explores your past as someone who was a fundamentalist Christian, who was a viewer of Fox News and a consumer of sort of right-wing radio like Rush Limbaugh, who, you know, you talk about in the book as well. And it's just so relevant. It's a crossroads of, you know, you talk about the media and how the conservative media, you talk about religion and fundamentalist Christianity. You talk about politics and everything that's going on. Some of the hot button issues like abortion and gun rights and the mindset that creates it. And what I really liked about it is that it really shows the other side. You've walked that walk and you make a case a lot of times for empathy to truly understand that side. If you don't understand it, then you can't have a conversation about it. Then you can't move beyond it. So I just really love the book. I think it's just really relevant. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's a weird thing, you know, to look back and see the image of yourself when you're driving down the road listening to right-wing radio, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage, Glenn Beck, Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, and you're like, man, yeah, this country's under attack. They're coming for my freedoms. They're coming for my guns. Those liberals, those seculars, those atheists, you know, you get yourself worked up. And by the time you get home, you're just a wreck. You know, you're just an absolute wreck. And of course, the truth of it was, what freedom did they actually take away? Like, you know, what specific thing was I losing? And the truth was nothing. In fact, I was enjoying tremendous privilege, so much more than I don't know how many other demographics within this country. And yet I'd convinced myself, and right-wing radio and Fox News had convinced me that I was, I mean, I'm always under attack. They're always coming. They're just around the corner. They are going to take all of the goodness away and everything is going to be on fire. And you know, that's a business model for a lot of these people. Outrage is profitable, you know, that sort of controversy for clicks kind of thing.
So you have a theme in the book, and I'm just going to paraphrase it. So please, you know, flesh it out as you see fit, is that, you know, one of the differences that you talk about between this sort of conservative mindset and the liberal mindset is that you talked about studies where liberals would look at happy children and, you know, puppies and things like that, and that they would respond better to that, whereas conservatives would tend to look at negative things. And there's this sort of, I guess I would summarize it by saying that conservatives are more driven by fear of things happening and liberals are driven by hope. And hope and fear are both actually quite similar fundamentally, because they're both anticipatory, anticipating something that hasn't happened or that could happen. And if you look at leaders, political leaders, I mean, they usually use one or the other. Like, most of them will use either fear that everything is going to go to shit, so, you know, you better do this and vote for us, or, you know, everything is, you know, we need hope for the future, we can make everything better. It's one of those things. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's, you know, I was talking to Dr. Hector Garcia, and I had narrated his book, Alpha God, which talked about our evolved tendencies. And he'd gotten really deep into a lot of brain studies. How do people think? What tendencies have we evolved? Mm-hmm. And there are trends, and there are going to be exceptions to these rules. So it's not a blanket statement. But the trends were that people who were more tied to routine, who were more afraid of trying new things, who were more xenophobic, who traveled less, they were more germophobic, that type of thing. They tended to skew more conservative. The people who traveled more, who had they didn't have as great a fear of things like infection and virus and people who were not like them or didn't identify like them sexually or otherwise. Those people tended, obviously, to skew more liberal. And there is an interesting discussion to be had about, you know, are their brains actually different? They talk about, like, the amygdala responding to these messages that are emotional targets to the brain. And fear is a powerful emotion. Right. You know, we look at Donald Trump. He has such an effective way of grabbing people who are paranoid in the first place and making them afraid, even more afraid. They're coming for you. They're going to take away your guns. They're going to take away your freedom. There's a horde of immigrants at the southern border, and they're climbing over the walls right now, and they're all rapists, you know, and they're all coming here to take your jobs and to ruin America. And there's a demographic that responds to that much more, and it largely skews conservative. And it's interesting to see that, you know, the brain of people who vote or act or live or have a certain philosophy, you know, there are markers which kind of reveal that their brains actually might be a little bit different. I find that interesting.
Mm-hmm. Armin?
What would you say to people that say, well, this is true, all of the stuff that you and Ali are saying is true on the other side as well? Do a whataboutism, you guys focusing on just Fox News, but the liberals are also going insane. They're also very biased. This is not a one-sided
thing. I think
thing.
They're right. Well, with a caveat. Bias exists wherever people exist. And I do grow tired. In fact, I dedicated my whole last chapter of the book to liberal extremism because I'm sick of it. This idea that, you know, we can't address problems in our own house, that we're either flawless or whatever flaws we have, we shouldn't ever focus on because the greater flaws over here deserve all of our attention. There's a dogmatism to the way some liberals think. And
it's called, the chapter is called The Loony Left. Liberals aren't immune to bad ideas.
And I think we aren't. We're human beings. So when did we lose the ability to self-reflect and self-criticize? And I'd sure rather us address this stuff from within our own house than to allow Sean Hannity to be the guy who's going to do it, because we know he's not going to be doing it fairly. But I don't think that all opinions are equal. I don't think all disagreements represent equal positions, equal in terms of credibility. I don't think all bias is the same. We're going to find, in fact, if you go to AdFonce Media, they've done a lot of charting of how media is biased one way or the other. And it's true. You know, you'll find MSNBC, they're skewed very left. You know, organizations, of course, like Occupy Democrats, but even Alternet and other, they skew really liberal. And then you've got Breitbart and that kind of thing that are skewing really far right. But Fox News is to me a different animal. The origins of Fox News, Roger Ailes' long history in the Republican Party, his long-standing desire to try to impose Republican talking points, mask and masquerade it as news. This goes back to the 1960s. And, you know, the level of bad information coming out of Fox, the way it's targeted, even down to the way the network is designed, the red, white, and the blue, and the bombastic sound effects, and the glitter, and the flag pins, and all of these things. This is a targeting of a specific kind of audience that responds to these sort of jingoistic symbols, and they respond to this language, often of persecution. And so my response is that it doesn't fit in a box. We're all guilty of bias. All networks and all pundits will have a level of bias because they're human beings. But I don't believe it's all equal. And I think the information that we're seeing, the representation of facts or misrepresentation of facts, I don't think there's any contest between CNN, the New York Times, PBS, Bloomberg, you know, any of those outlets. Compared to Fox News, there's no contest. Fox News is by far the worse animal.
One thing that I want to mention is that I have been spending a lot of time going after the woke mob, or what you call the loony liberals.
That's what Fox News called them. So I was tweaking that a little bit with the book chapter. I don't walk around calling the left the loony left. But yeah, okay. I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I got
right.
You.
But I want to, like you mentioning the level being a lot, the level of the influence being a lot more with Fox News. This is something that I think that a lot of people don't realize, because the reason why we're going after the woke cult is because they're trying to become more and more mainstream, and in some cases they've been successful, but they can't. They are basically hoping that they become as mainstream as something like Fox News already is, right? So as much as we're trying to hold back against them so that the woke cult does not become more mainstream, when it comes to especially a lot of Christian influence on politics and our media, they're already there. They're like 20 steps ahead of them, right? So we shouldn't forget to fight that fight as well.
Right. Yeah, I think self-reflection, self-analysis, certainly I'm an opponent of dogmatism. You know, I think dogmatism is the enemy of how we find good information, how we bridge the gaps between us, how we create and cultivate allies. You know, one thing about the extreme left, they are like the extremist of any demographic or tribe. They are, you know, they have a purity test. And if you are 95% in, but not 100, then you are the out group. You are not invited in. You are not accepted, perhaps even vilified. But, you know, I don't think, And here's the other, you know, when it comes to, I think some of the people who have embraced that kind of extreme ideology really are convinced that they are operating for meritorious reasons. Like they really do want to be doing the right thing. But I think they're handling in a very destructive way that actually is counterproductive in the long run. And then there are just some shitty people. There are just shitty people in this world who take worthy causes and shield their toxicity behind the worthy cause. So if they go out and they're acting in an untoward way, and they're supposedly, ostensibly about this particular cause, and you criticize and say, no, you're doing real damage, they then hide behind the cause and say, oh yeah, Seth is an enemy of women's rights, BLM, you know, whatever.
Well, I want to read an excerpt from your book that is kind of relevant to this that I think really nailed, even though it appears in the abortion chapter, but it sort of applies to what we're talking about here. Is while you're talking about abortion, you know, you say, well, some people might ask, why is a man rendering an opinion? Yeah. And then you go on to say, quote, I reject these kinds of purity tests regarding human rights issues. I don't need to be black to grasp that racism is immoral and why. I don't have to be ex-Muslim to see the moral contradictions in Islam. I can be straight and promote LGBT rights. I can be non-military. Oh, hold on. I can be non-military and oppose unjust wars. And I can be male and value gender equality and reproductive anatomy, engaging in moral reasoning alongside my fellow human beings. These are human rights issues on the table for discussion across the board, especially recognizing that the abortion issue is often decided by couples, not an individual, end quote. But this is, I think, really at the heart of, I know you're talking about abortion here, but this is at the heart of this entire woke cult thing that Armin's talking about. And this is where we're in complete agreement that this idea that you can't even be an ally, right? You can't even be in it. Like they want allies, but you can't even be one unless you are quiet, as long as you don't belong to that community. And that has never happened. You've never had any transformative change in history without the people who were in power, like, you know, men supporting women's rights or straight people supporting gay rights. I mean, nothing would have happened if that didn't happen, if people didn't speak out like that.
Do you think we're doing a kind of purity testing here as well? Because we're all here anti-woke, but we think, like, we sometimes forget that the right wing, especially the fundamentalist Christians, have a lot more influence right now than the woke cult. But we have this purity test that you need to shit on the woke before you get to shit on, you know, right-wing fund. Like, we're like, hey, make sure before, like, can you acknowledge to me that you understand that the woke cult is dangerous before you start attacking the right? Like, is that like a purity test that we have for each other?
I don't, that's not really my thing. Like, most of what I do, if I'm talking these days, it's about the Trumpster fire. You know, it's about the United States of Trumpistan and the assault of the evangelical right on the courts and the Department of Education and Energy and the Attorney General talking about Israel in terms of the end times. And you know, we talk about pseudoscience and conspiracy theories. All of this is tied to the mindset of the right-wing evangelical demographic that feeds and fuels and is also fed by and fueled by Fox News. So I spend most of my time directed there because I think they're the most dangerous animal right now. Mm-hmm. But I do think that we have to be able to analyze and reflect on ourselves, and that's important as well. And it's not a cheat to look at problems within the liberal camp or people waving the liberal banner who might be doing some damage or doing or being a part of the problem or just shitty human beings and saying, this is not good. You know, that's not a cheat of the larger battle that we're fighting right now. And so I feel like there needs to be some balance. And but there is a demographic of people who think, well, as long as this exists, why would you ever talk about us? We're not the problem. You know, we want to be insulated. Or I hear, if you criticize from within, you're tone policing. Well, no, actually, I was making an assessment of what you were saying and doing and saying that I disagree with it. You know, it's not, I'm not policing your tone. I'm saying I disagree with what you are doing. It's that simple. But there's a deflection for every criticism. There is no doubt.
Yeah. When you talk about bias and the different media outlets and everybody's bias, it took me a while to really wrap my head around this. And I came down to two things. There's neutrality and there's objectivity. Right? And they say that the press and the media, they're not supposed to be neutral. You know, you don't take, liberals on one side and then Nazis on the other and say, okay, both of these have equal stories. So, you know, go ahead and go at each other. Let's have a discussion. You don't, that's neutrality is not what it's about. It's about objectivity, right? So there are different, not all sides are equal, as you said, not all biases are equal. For me, the test has been, and I'd be interested in what you think about this, is that I when I look at analysis, you know, after a debate or after a speech, and I look at MSNBC or CNN, a lot of times they'll have analysts who'll come on, like David Axelrod, and he'll have a kind of an analysis of the event. But when I go to Fox News, or if I go to like the, you know, so one of these things, it's predictable. I know what they're going to say. This is one of the problems, and I am a fan, a selective fan of Noam Chomsky. I've always liked him, but I can always predict his position on any given issue without reading it. Even if I haven't read it, I'll always kind of know, okay, well, this is what he's going to think about it. And that to me has always been a sort of test of the most rigid and dogmatic kind of biases.
I think that it's fair. In fact, it's even right to have an expectation. If I'm a reporter, right? All right, I'm Jonathan Swan. And I was doing the Axios interview for HBO when I sat down with Donald Trump for 30 minutes, brutal. Which is excruciating, by the way. Mm-hmm. And he deserves a Purple Heart and a stiff drink for getting through that without throttling the man. But he has every right to walk in with the expectation that he's going to get a bunch of nonsense answers, made up facts, a bunch of references to very smart people who back him up, blah, blah, blah. And so you could call that bias, but I see it as he actually has sort of front-loaded his perspective and expectation based on a long history of behavior. And so, you know, I think we can bring that into the table, and it's not necessarily a net negative. In fact, many times I think it may be constructive. You know, you're actually bringing in, you might be bringing in a little bit of baggage, but it's baggage that you probably should bring in with you, given the history of the person you're dealing with. It's like talking to a MAGA Trumper here in the state of Oklahoma. You know, having had enough interactions, yeah, I'm biased. When I go in, I feel like here's what's going to happen and they're going to do this and I'm already kind of front-loaded. But that's partially an expectation based on past experience. What I do feel about liberals, and I think the data bears this out, we are more apt to self-reflect and we are more apt to change our minds when presented with a better point of view. Not nearly enough, but as opposed to a right-winger, someone who has more liberal values is actually more inclined to improve a position once they have been corrected. And I want to be that guy. You know, sometimes it stings, sometimes it hurts. Nobody wants to be wrong. Most people hate being corrected. Oh, shit, I'm wrong. You know, I got that argument wrong, or I made this claim and it was wrong, and I've got to go apologize for it. But we do, because at the end of the day, I think we are more interested in not starting with the answer, but following the breadcrumbs to find out where the answer is. And, you know, go ahead, brother. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying if you use the word liberal and instead of left, then what you're saying is even more true, because the problems we have with the people, a lot of people on the left, is the woke cult, who we don't even consider them to be liberals anyways. You know what I mean? Like, so
because, yeah, I mean, good luck nailing all the, we got liberal, we got left, we got progressive. I get a little, it's hard because I feel like everybody's subjectively defining those terms. Does anybody else struggle with that?
Liberal seems pretty obvious that, you know, I mean, that is something that based on most definitions that everybody uses, it does seem like the woke cult is pushing for illiberal values. I mean, this is something that even a lot of people on the left even recognize. Even Fairy Zakaria was talking about this way before the woke cult became a thing. He was worried about illiberal values being pushed in Western countries, right? So I don't know. I do think that this is, like, I don't think, like, we should dismiss the definition of words just because some people misuse it, because it becomes very difficult to communicate if you just throw away all the
labels. I think more than that, though, I don't, like, I myself think liberal and left, and I think the same thing. You know, well, I'm left. I'm not right.
I mean, communism. I'm not center. I mean, let's take it to the extreme to see how they're not the same. Communism is pretty left, but it's definitely the most one of extremely not against liberalism. I mean,
yeah, that's fair. Liberalism is a tough word because. It's because liberal, even conservatives are technically liberal, right? Like the classical liberalism was really about libertarianism. It was about enlightenment values. So, you know, modern conservatives and modern Democrats and like liberals, quote unquote liberals, are all under the whole classical liberal umbrella. So I hear you. I think that
it makes your head hurt. You just say, okay, all right. Well, but yeah.
It becomes more complicated if you start looking into the splitting of the Overton window. Look into that if you want to get even more complicated. That the liberal, the people that are conservative liberals and leftist liberals, they're becoming less and less because the window is not shifting. It's splitting right in the middle and going more left and more right. And the liberal that was supposed it's a war on liberalism from both sides, from both the right and the left.
Well, but that's more complicated. This is probably the main reason that we need to clean house from within and to address issues from within. It's almost like being an atheist activist. There have been people who are atheists and call themselves atheist activists, and they go out and they're just awful people doing destructive things. They don't represent me or my values. And so there comes a point when you do say, you know, this is not correct. Now, someone could argue that I was anti-atheist activism, but the truth was, is I'm actually acting because I care about, you know, who's going to discover these atheist activists. If they're a seeker coming out of the faith, asking questions, blah, blah, blah. I want them to find the best of us. You know, I want to change the world for the positive. And so you criticize from within, or, you know, whenever you find it appropriate and it's not too much of a distraction from your main mission. I think we have to do that. But I only dedicate like one of the chapters to the left, because really my focus is more on this rampant overrun right now of the evangelicals. And that's why I'm so discouraged by some of the people who just seem... They don't seem to get November. For them, they're like, ah, fuck it. You know, Biden wasn't my guy. He's this, he's that. You know, who cares? Harris, I don't care, whatever. I'm not going to vote third party, or I'm just going to stay home. You know, I'm going to take my ball and go home. And I'm like, I'm not voting for Biden, right? We need, first of all, we got to get Trump out of there. And this is historic. This is something that no one has ever seen. It cannot continue. We are the laughingstock of the world. We got 170,000 people dead. We've got the man hugely abusing a taxpayer-funded office to prefer one specific demographic, a religious right that he knows really nothing about except how to pander to them. And I'm voting for who's going to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the Supreme Court. That's right. Who I'm voting for.
Go ahead. Sorry, finish what you're saying.
Who's going to be the next Secretary of Education, the next Secretary of Energy? Who's going to be heading up NASA next? You know, who's going to be appointing judges, hopefully not evangelical activist judges in the courts, all the way down to the state and local level? This is not about a specific one candidate. It's about the repercussions of getting Trump Pence out of office in November. And I try to communicate that. And there are some who just cock their head and look at me like I'm a sellout. I do not understand it, Ali.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
So going into this aspect of your book, right, where you talked about right-wing talk radio, right-wing, you know, the Rush Limbaughs and everything of the world. Yeah. And you just mentioned that Trump, you know, the only thing you can do with the Christians is pander to them. From your perspective, as someone who was there, you wrote in your book that you used to listen to Rush on the drive home after you did your radio show. Mm-hmm. You listen to that monologue. And as a Christian, all of he spoke to you, and you were able to just ignore all of his three marriages, and you know, all of his, like, I don't know, his drug addictions, and you know, the Viagra and all the other stuff that was going on. And we're seeing the same thing here with Trump. I mean, this guy he holds the Bible as a prop. I did that interview we did with Mark Halperin, where he asked him to name his favorite Bible verse, and he's like, you know, well, which one?
Well,
which
it's personal.
He's like, old or new? You know, a bit of both.
I would like to quiz the man. Right? He said that the Bible's his favorite book after his own. And I'm like, I would pay $1,000 to sit in front of Donald Trump and just, let's do a pre-dementia screening like you've been proud of in the past. Let's do, name for me the first three words of the Bible. Let's, and he would pass the test. Give me the first three words.
Right.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ali. I'm going to get excited.
No, that's great.
Like talking about Trump and the Bible in the same sentence. You got
we do have to say two things before we go on. One is person, woman, man, camera, TV, and the other is hashtag #best. Be best, everybody. And Armin has a question too, I think.
Well, to speak to your question, I see
but,
that.
I wanted to, just one last thing, just to actually ask the question, is that what is it about, how did you reconcile some of these people, and how do you think the fundamentalist Christians are actually reconciled? Why is he so popular with them, even though there is nothing quote unquote Christian about it?
Well, I didn't have a ton of knowledge about Rush's personal life. His situation is a little bit different than Trump's, but I did excuse, you know, the fact that he had, you know, like for us, divorce was a sin. But a lot of the other stuff that he said at the time spoke to my extremely narrow worldview. And I was willing to excuse the other stuff because, you know, I felt like, well, the greater good. And with Trump, I was talking to cult expert Stephen Hassan about this. He's written a book called The Cult of Trump. And what Trump has is really sort of a cultish allegiance, his following. They're like cult members, where Trump hasn't just shaped their reality, he has become their reality. And you see these tactics. He says the words over and over and over to imprint them in their minds, fake news, fake news, fake news. So now, when somebody comes up with a legitimate question or criticism, what's the first thing the MAGAs do? Fake news, you're fake news, you're fake news. They're dismissing the messenger. There's sort of a king. I think they see him as God's king who has come. So that way, when he tramples over the law, well, you know, that's what kings do. He's the authority put in place by my God. He speaks to Christianity with lip service, and that's all many of these people need. Again, these are people who've embraced an entire religion without knowing what's in their own Bible. Mm-hmm. So lip service for them, you know, it's emotional connection. It's not an intellectual exercise. So if somebody comes and says, I'm going to defend God, well, they'll, you know, wave the banner and say, hey, great, sign me up. I think many people see Trump as kind of a King Cyrus figure. He's a flawed man that God uses. And God often uses terrible people to enact his will. I mean, they've got gymnastics that they do on behalf of this man. Here's the question I like to pose to Trump supporters. If your son or your husband or your father or your male boss or whatever had come to you and they had done this, and I would list a lot of the stuff that Trump has done and said, how would you feel? And they're like, no, I'd hate that. Would you live with that? No, I wouldn't abide that. I wouldn't put up with that. But Trump's different. And it's interesting to watch them treat Trump with a totally different set of rules. Mm-hmm. And there's a tremendous amount of mental calisthenics taking place because I think they've made an emotional connection to this savior narrative that he sold at the 2016 convention. He said, I alone can fix it. That's right. Out of 7 billion people, Nobel laureates and scientists and great philosophers and thinkers and economists said, oh, yeah, screw those guys. I alone, one man, is able to come and be the savior. This is a culture that has been trained to respond to authoritarian models. He is the authority with a capital A. He invokes God, who is another authority, and they line up lockstep like lemmings.
Armin?
I'm going to play devil's advocate here and be like, actually, the Christians seem to not have, they know exactly what they were doing, and they got exactly some what did. They wanted.
I think some did.
The fact that, but they would say that the fact that Trump doesn't seem to be like very Christian or have Christian values or say things that, you know, they think that's irrelevant. We wanted him to get us the Supreme Court judges that we wanted, and he did. And they also saying this is not even in contradiction to our ideology. Our ideology is that God uses flawed people to, to carry out his plan. And Trump, as flawed as he is, he carried out God's plan. And you guys keep make fun of him, about his rape allegations, about the things that he says. But you guys keep, entertaining yourself and making fun of the fact that we voted for somebody that doesn't seem to have Christian values. You keep doing that while we enjoy the Supreme Court judges that we got for the next, I don't know how many years, and all the and everything that they now make precedent for decades to come. We're happy with what we got. We knew what we voted strategically. We were being smart about it. We weren't brainwashed, and we got the result of our, investments. Our predictions came true.
So I live in Oklahoma. This is a strawberry red conservative Republican state. I can think of a few people in my mind right now. One guy, he's a conservative. He had such a bad taste in his mouth when he voted for Trump back in 2016. But he thought, I'm voting because Trump is... He voted on business because he bought the notion that Trump is a stellar businessman, which is a lie. And he voted probably even more so on the abortion question. He was almost in that way a single issue voter. But he did not endorse Trump, the man, as an awful human being, as a sexual predator, as someone who cheated children's charities, et cetera. He put all that over here in a little box, and he said, these two are my big issues, and that's what I'm going to stick with. And then I can think of someone else, and Trump actually reflects their view of the world. They're xenophobic. They're bigots. They have a bad view about women and people of other nations, and they respond to his awfulness, and he is a reflection of them. I don't think you can put his support in any one box. I do think there are good people who have rationalized their way through the support of this awful man. I think it's important to try to break through if we can and try to appeal to their better nature. But, they've mostly, those people, I think, have decided that it's either about abortion, and it's what Catherine Stewart calls the power worshipers, right, where it's mostly about whatever we have to do to make sure that the Republican Party stays in power. And so they've sort of decided to excuse awfulness. There are probably a spectrum of rationalizations and reasons people have, and none of them fit in a box. It's hugely frustrating, no doubt.
I think, I actually really agree with Armin's point. I think that there was a time when I was thinking, I think it was after Anthony Kennedy stepped out of the Supreme Court, where I felt like they were having the last laugh. A lot of the sort of the Christian fundamentalists and, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's like the four-time cancer survivor, just recently hospitalized for pneumonia. So we have a situation where if Trump is reelected, you could potentially have a 7-2 conservative majority Supreme Court. And the ultimate authority, the final word in the United States, is the Supreme Court. And they have lifetime appointments. Okay, so if you have a situation like that and they want to overturn Roe v. Wade, all they have to do is start changing laws, and then people start appealing those laws, and it goes to the Supreme Court, and they will overturn it. It's gone. Even now, they can do it. They probably will. So if I was a Christian fundamentalist, evangelical Christian, and I really wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade or get rid of this whole, the wall between church and state and reinterpret that or whatever. I would understand why, you know, there's a reason, because even if Trump isn't a Christian evangelical himself, he will come out and he will give you what you want. He will come out like, I will give you what you want if you support me. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a totally fair point. I think you're right. I think it's, you know, this is another King Cyrus narrative, right? God uses awful people to enact his ends, to achieve his goal and his mission. And they see the United States as a Christian nation. They bought hook, line, and sinker into this God and country narrative. One nation under God, our specific God with a proper name, Yahweh Jesus. Everybody else is essentially a second-class citizen who's kind of borrowing all the good stuff that America has to offer. And if Trump makes that happen or reinforces it or makes them more powerful, then yeah, sure, they'll line up behind him. I think that's a fair point.
Yeah.
How do you respond to people that say, listen, Fox is getting better? They had, you know, earlier they had like Bernie Sanders on, and they treated him very fair, and they had a very supporting audience. They are becoming more critical of people on the right. They're calling out Trump sometimes. I mean, not on some of their shows, but on other shows they have, they call him out on his BS. They had one of the best interviews with Trump, and they were extreme. They didn't hold back. They were extreme. I mean, maybe if you focus on the Hannitys and some Fox and Friends, those are completely biased and pro-Trump. But there are other segments of Fox News that, I mean, they had one of the best interviews with Trump and they didn't hold back, and it was very embarrassing to Trump. And it seems like they are trying to not just appeal. They're trying to come a little bit closer to the center and appeal to a larger audience. What would you say to that?
I would say that the network is not challenging Trump more. Chris Wallace's interview with Trump was terrific. And Chris Wallace has been a refreshing voice in the wilderness at Fox News. He's a little bit like Shepard Smith was before turned in his resignation. You know, that guy must have been grinding his teeth for the last freaking, you know, 10 years. And he was good about speaking his mind. There are a few exceptions. Even Neil Cavuto, I've seen come out and challenge the Republican administration, criticize Donald Trump. But these are largely exceptions, not the rule. If we look at the entire primetime lineup of Fox News, who is it? It's Sean Hannity. It's Tucker Carlson. It's Laura Ingraham. These are right-wing activist commentators doing opinion pieces in prime time. This is a bulk of what Fox News ratings are about. Fox and Friends, Ainsley Earhart has a Bible study on Fox Nation. Steve Doocy and Brian Kilmeade, they're both believers. They are both evangelicals. So you've got the hugely rated morning and evening segments of the most popular news network in the United States that is essentially populated by evangelical Christians doing editorial content. And so while Chris Matthews does pop in occasionally and do actual journalism, and it's beautiful, and I'm so thankful for it, those are the exceptions. They are not the rule to Fox News.
Yeah, one of the things I was reading just recently, I think this article just came out yesterday in Vanity Fair, and it was about Sean Hannity and they interviewed some of his staffers anonymously, and they talked about how he has been very stressed out himself with the Trump presidency, and Trump apparently calls him all the time. Right? He talks to him for way longer than he would like to. He's almost like, they said that he's treating him like even like a wife in a sexless marriage.
Well, the report's coming out now that Trump's watching Lou Dobbs, and he would go to the Homeland Security officials and say, "Did you see Lou Dobbs? Well, I want to do that. Whatever he said last night. That's how I feel."
He postponed a meeting with a call with the Chinese head of state, right? to do a phone-in on the Hannity show. And Hannity's apparently been saying that the guy's batshit crazy. But Hannity's also apparently, you know, he is very good friends with people on other, like, liberal media channels. And it seems like a lot of what he does is not necessarily it's not necessarily representative of who he is. Now, I don't know about this report. This is just something I read yesterday. But it does feel like that to me a lot of times with Fox News, too, that some of these people are disingenuous. It is more of a business and ratings enterprise than a news.
It may be. I cannot speak to their intent. You know, Sean Hannity, I used to be a big Hannity guy. You know, I used to think he was, he's a voice that represents the, you know, God and country America that I love, you know. Mm-hmm. And now I look at him and I'm like, almost everything he says is just wrong. I mean, demonstrably wrong. I mean, he does a whole bunch of this God and country. We are a Judeo-Christian nation. And I'm like, just a cursory look at the founding. I mean, Andrew Seidel's book, The Founding Myth, does a better job than I do into it.
He's been on the show and he's phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at this guy, when Christopher Hitchens was interviewed by Sean Hannity, I remember Hitch looked at him and said, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but you give me the impression that you have not read any of the criticisms of your position ever. That's exactly how I feel when I look at Sean. He's in a reinforcement culture. He's producing these Christian pure flicks movies with Kevin Sorbo starring in them. You know, he's actually guest starred in one of them. Sean Hannity, I believe, if he didn't appear, he was on the roster to appear at a Trump event. I mean, this is a supposed journalist who's going and standing on stage with a specific candidate to endorse the candidate. So this is not journalism. This is not reporting. This is a straight up opinion show that's being broadcast under the headline of quote unquote news. It's certainly not fair and balanced. And that's for sure.
Seth, how did you, Armin, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, what would you respond to people who say, listen, I don't like Fox's Christian or right-wing propaganda, but my focus right now is to fight back against this PC culture, the cancel culture, or wokeism, or whatever you want to call it. And the voices against the tsunami of these bad ideas are so weak, and it seems like a lot of these people are taking over. And unfortunately, not that many people with big outlets in mainstream media are calling it out. I mean, there are some, but there are not that many big voices that stands against that. And as bad as Fox might be, we need them. They are the only ones that are actually, you know, Tucker Carlson or other people with huge audiences. They're calling it out. And even though I'm against them when it comes to their Christian propaganda or right-wing propaganda or their bigotry or whatever, I do appreciate that such a big major outlet on mainstream media, at least they are spreading the ideas for why this woke cult is wrong. And given that they're the only big voice that does this, we do kind of need them. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think I disagree with the premise. I don't think Fox News is the only major outlet that speaks to this. I also think that Fox News doesn't have the equity of credibility to be a reliable arbiter of criticisms about the liberal attitude or claim. I just don't think, oh, look, the broken clock is right twice a day, so I'll buy the clock. I don't feel that way about Fox News. I understand the concerns about cancel culture, et cetera, but I am seeing, you know, we're examples of people who are liberals who are resisting and standing against it and calling it out from within. So while I do see that there's a lot of it out there, as soon as it happens, I also see a whole lot of other liberals jump in and say, nah, that's too much. So we don't need Fox News to clean house. We don't need Fox News to address it. And I certainly don't think that the fact that they're occasionally the blind squirrel that finds the nut makes them something we want to rely on or support in terms of ratings and revenue. I think they remain a major problem. We have to focus on the problem and lean to better sources. That would be my response.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get into, I really enjoyed what you wrote in the manufactured persecution thing. So I wanted to talk about, you know, because there's persecution is a big thing. Everybody's talking about who's more persecuted. And, you know, there is a little bit of the oppression Olympics thing going on. And Fox News and Christian conservatives seem to be, they've sort of had a head start on it for a very long time, especially, you know, Christmas is under attack. Yeah. Is it fair to respond to people who say, you know, well, you're saying holiday tree, not Christmas tree, holiday vacation, you know, not Christmas. Is it okay to tell them, hey, all holidays matter?
Yeah, you can say any way you want. It's funny. I'm an atheist. I say Merry Christmas all the time. You know, hey, Merry Christmas.
Yeah, me too.
Well, they actually lie about it. They'll say things like, well, Obama never said Merry Christmas to anybody, and we're going to bring Christmas back, and Trump says Christmas. And that's just not true. He says,
well, I put a screenshot of a tweet from Obama in the book talking about the Christmas tree. But
overall, just the persecution thing, like this idea that when you were there in that mindset, right, as a Christian, as a Fox News guy, and as a Christian talk radio guy, did you feel, if you travel back in time to that mindset, did you feel that there was persecution, you were under attack, and everybody was out to get you? And what was that like? Why did you feel that way, and how did you eventually break out of it?
Yeah, I was trained to expect that they're coming, right? God's under attack. If I'm not under attack by Satan, then I must be of no concern to Satan. Well, if I'm of no concern, that means I'm a bad Christian. So I need to be persecuted for Christ's sake, which is something he commanded his followers to do in the New Testament, to be persecuted for his sake. What do you do in a country where you enjoy maximal privilege?
Right. Persecution is central to the Christian identity.
What do? You manufacture the persecution. You make it up out of whole cloth and say, I'm being persecuted. What's that Emerson quote that says, let me never fall under the vulgar mistake that I'm being persecuted whenever I am contradicted? Yeah. Well, I wasn't being persecuted, but I was being occasionally contradicted. And then my hairs on the back of my neck would go up, and I would brace my spine and say, you're persecuting me, or you're insulting my God, or you are berating in some way. But I mean, I can worship anywhere I want, any day I want. I can wear religious t-shirts and jewelry and tattoos, the religious radio stations and television stations. There's a good chance my elected congressman is a Christian. I can go to a Marriott and there's a freaking Bible in the hotel room dresser drawer. There's Jesus everywhere. I mean, this whole idea that I was persecuted was just a lie that I told myself to make myself feel more important. I manufactured the persecution. And what that did further is it locked me out of other people's perspectives. It locked me more into my little bubble. And so now, and it's been statistically measured that people who are Fox News conservatives, they are actually more prone to get their news about the world from a single news source, where liberals tend to rely more on a variety of sources, everything from NPR to CNN to the New York Times to local news to Facebook and Twitter. I mean, they're always kind of assembling the data and checking it out, cross-referencing. We've got our biases, but we aren't locked into this conduit where one narrative is the world. But 40% of Trump voters who were surveyed, 40% got their news exclusively from Fox News, meaning that Fox News had shaped their perception of the world, of the nation, of the candidates, of the issues, of the entire election. It's stunning to think of the implications. And if Fox News finds that a persecution narrative, we're a Christian nation and the seculars are coming, Jesus is being persecuted by the atheist, they want to strip Christmas away so that it's illegal to be a Christmas follower, or, you know, to observe the Christmas holiday religiously. They're coming. It's a slippery slope. Just one day, you know, that is that reinforces the persecution narrative. Now you're sitting forward in your chair. Now the two things are fueling each other in a feedback loop of outrage. Oh, look, they're the advertisers. They're making a shit ton of money. And the ratings continue to go through the roof. It's, I had that mindset when I was a Fox News Christian, that's for sure. And I'm glad I broke free. I feel like my life is so much better now. So.
Just to be clear, Christians are being persecuted, just not in the United States.
That's absolutely correct.
Right, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, and also it's important for us anti-religious advocates to be careful. But just because if one day we do notice that some people are being abused even in United States for being Christian, just because this hasn't been a thing for a while, we shouldn't avoid calling that out if and when it does happen, right?
Agreed.
I've
seen this with Islam recently too, with the anti-Muslim bigotry that's happened. I mean, you and I are atheists, right? We disagree with the truth claims of Islam and the damage done by the dogma of Islam. But when we see people who are being persecuted for practicing a Muslim faith in the United States being vilified, you know, Trump and et cetera, who did he go after? Was it Omar, one of the two? Is she a true American? I think it was him that said that. You know, that's something that we stand up against, because we are not just defending the rationalist position, but we are also defending the Constitution. And we are humanists, and we feel that that's morally wrong to do that. So, I totally agree.
Sorry, Armin, should I go ahead, or you want to ask something?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I wanted to get, but this persecution thing that you told me is fascinating, because I actually didn't. I always knew it, but I didn't really make that direct connection between how the sense of religious persecution, how persecution is highlighted. And, you know, we're, Armin and I are both from Shia Muslim background, so, you know, we've got our own sort of Jesus-like figure in Imam Hussein that we grew up with, who's also sacrificed his life for, you know, everybody else and for the Ummah. So it plays really well. I guess this is a little bit of an anecdote, but I'm working on a novel right now, and I was thinking of how to define the hero and craft that character. And I realized that you don't really have a hero if you don't have a villain. If you don't have the obstacles, you know, the hero, like if it's a character, if it's a teacher in a school, you know, he's just going to be a teacher in a school unless he does something heroic, which is fight against a villain. So you really do need a villain to create a hero. Otherwise, it's just a regular person. And so that's why this, this specifically caught my eye, this idea of manufactured persecution. Is there any way to, do you think this is what actually spills out from the religious mindset into the politics?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends. It's funny, back to your first point, I saw a meme, the old Tom and Jerry cartoon, the cat and the mouse.
Yeah.
Cat's always chasing the mouse. And the meme said something like, why doesn't the cat ever catch the mouse? And the reason is because if he does, the story's over. The same is true with God and Satan. Like, God is the most powerful being in the cosmos. Satan is already going, he's going to be defeated. Why didn't God defeat Satan right now at the beginning of time? Well, the truth is if you don't have an antagonist, then the protagonist can't do his heroic deeds. You've got to have the bad guy.
Yeah, it's what Armin was saying about the woke cult too. Like
they'll
create, you have to, the thing is people want to feel heroic, especially on social media. Everyone wants to out-moral each other. It's like, oh, Biden's good, Trump, nah, they're both the same. I'm way better than both of them. You know, it's stuff like that. And when they do that and they want to outdo each other morally, they want to feel like heroes. They want to feel like they're heroic. So if there isn't a villain and if there isn't an antagonist, they have to manufacture something.
Yeah. Right.
So
that's why God is never going to win, because that would end the story. That's why the Mehdi will never come back when it comes to the Shias. And that's why racism will never end, and it will always exist everywhere, even when you don't see it, because you always have to have an enemy, and you have to deny any kind of progress that you've already made. So, yeah, it's pretty consistent. It works everywhere.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. And when it's actually enshrined and endorsed in scripture by the creator of the universe, then it takes on a power of its own. I've seen like the emails that you get, you know, you sign up to the Trump mailing list, the Trump campaign, and then the Biden mailing list, and you really do see this fear and hope. Like if you, they'll say something like, we've got 14 tickets or 1400 tickets to the Tulsa rally, you know, your hometown. And then they'll keep on sending you messages. Hey, we had 14 tickets. So why haven't you signed up yet? You know, Trump will be so disappointed in you. This is amazing. Come on. That's shame on you. Like they'll actually send you emails like that.
Really?
I'm not kidding.
In the how do you look at the moment by moment tweet storm tantrums and the bullying and the things that he focuses on? You know, I halfway through his niece's book, Dr. Mary Trump's book, mm-hmm. called Too Much and Not Enough, which talks about his formative years and kind of the his father and the relationship that he had with his dad and his brother and whatnot. You begin to see the roots of how a sociopath like Trump sort of comes together. But when you see, you know, the guy who can't pronounce Yosemite, the guy who asks if we can drop nuclear weapons into hurricanes, the guy who's constantly doing all the crazy shit that we cannot believe a sitting president is doing, and then turns around and he's just awful to other human beings, calling them names like psycho and horse face and, you know, blah, blah, blah. The demographic that responds positively to that terrifies me. Mm-hmm. Trump is a problem. Trump is not the problem. Trump is a black light that has been shining on the United States since his rise to political power, which has revealed an underbelly of bigotry and ignorance and conspiracy thinking and all kinds of awfulness. It's been there, but now we're seeing it more and more. I'm tremendously discouraged. I mean, what kind of a country allows this insanity in the first place? I was hoping to maybe come to Canada for just a little while till it all sort of blows over, but Armin moved out of Canada. So are you still up there, up north, Ali? Are you still there?
I am, but if you come here, you're going to have to quarantine for 14 days.
To the US. Come where I am instead. It's more sunny and we have more beautiful beaches here.
Just give me a place on the couch for a few months. You know, I just, you know, whatever.
In all honesty, I got to say, like, we have had friends who have come in quarantine because they need to get away from, like, especially in hotspot epicenters for coronavirus, for COVID. So
I just want to tell the rest of the world, not all of us have lost our minds. Not all of us are bigots and predators and sociopaths and pathological liars and absolute horrors of a human being. Please don't judge us all. In fact, I try to remind them, Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million. So, I mean, there's a little sliver of hope that maybe this country can recover. But I don't have a lot of optimism.
I want to tell you two personal anecdotes. I don't want to take up too much time. But before that, I want to ask you something else about your book. Because right now, people want to hear more from you than me. But I'll save that till the end. So you wrote in one of your chapters that I wanted to talk about this fake news thing. You know how Trump, you know, the first things that they do is they come up and they tell you that you can't trust anybody but them. Yeah. So you said Donald Trump constantly cries fake news. At his 2018 speech before the Veterans of Foreign Wars convention in Kansas City, Trump said, "Just remember what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening." I'm reminded of that line from George Orwell, quote, "The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command." And that is really at the heart of anything authoritarian. You don't have to have an authoritarian sort of government or state structure, anything like that. All you need to do, and you know, we know this about this in Iran, we know this about this in Pakistan too, is the first thing they tell you is that you can't trust the Western media. You can't trust the intelligence agencies. You can't trust the courts. You can't trust the judiciary. You can't trust anything because nobody will tell you the truth except for me. I'm your savior. You know, that kind of thing. It's something.
Well, Fox News' his own tagline, right? Fair and balanced. What's the implication? Everybody else, they're unfair and imbalanced.
So that's one thing that I want to know about, because that's something where, for instance, everybody else would be watching a debate between Trump and Hillary Clinton. And the most of us are watching it, reasonable people watching, they're like, clearly Hillary's making better points. But there is a mindset that's listening to him, like, yeah, he got her good. Yeah, he's right. Yeah, he may not have the right points, but he's really, you know, he's telling us the truth. Everybody else is lying. This constant conspiracy kind of thinking, how do you combat that? I mean, it's natural to people who are religious because that's the premise of how religions were made. But what do you do?
You know,
every time you talk to him, he's going to get stronger. You know,
I'm a speech guy. And I'm a Socratic method guy. Ask a lot of questions, leave the burden of proof on the person making the claim. We should be out there trying to change minds. All of this stuff is true. But the truth is, with me, I'm in a bad place. Like, I haven't given up, but at this moment, I feel like I'm trying to push through the conspiracy crowd instead of trying to convince them right now. I'm trying to push through them to get to November. My own mother, who blocked, she's not a friend of me on Facebook. My wife had to tell me that she posted this. my mom had friended me, and then she lasted 2 days, and she's like, I can't handle it. He's too much of a heathen. So she left. But anyway, but Natalie's still a friend with her. My mom posted that conspiracy theory that Bill Gates and Fauci roomed at Cornell and they were cooking up the RFID chip to track people, and that George Soros was behind the company that gassed the Jews during the Second World War, and now he's funding liberal causes. And Jeffrey Epstein was the majority stockholder in a vaccine company, and it's just it's this potpourri of all of these different conspiracies.
Going on, and
easily debunked, like so easily refuted if she had taken 15 seconds to check into it. But she shared it under the words, "Wake up, people. You are being led and controlled." Why did she share it? She's been trained her whole life to fear persecution, to think conspiratorially. She distrusts science and scientists and the evidence. She is one of those people who, if it fits the book of Revelation or her sort of, you know, end time narrative, or it's in contrast to what Trump told her was true, she doesn't get it. Those people terrify me. And we're seeing QAnon people elected to public office. Now they're being funded on the taxpayer dime as they're in positions of influence, which Trump has enabled. You know, people keep asking me, what do we do? I don't know what to do, Ali. I have no idea.
Okay, but just to be clear, things are getting better if you look at a long trend. You know, like this conspiracy theory thinking, this is not like, oh my god, like I was listening to Sam Harris. He was kind of acting like the fabric of society and everything is falling apart. And I'm like, when are they comparing this to? Like, when has this not been the case?
Well, no, but aren't we seeing something unique here, Armin? I mean, the internet has allowed all of these sort of wild conspiracies to catch fire almost immediately. Then we have the controversy or conspiracy for clicks business. There are actually companies that have monetized these stories. So they go out, and the more outraged and clicky people get, the more money they and their advertisers make. You've got Russia that's interfering in social media, that's actually sending out whole campaigns to try to impact American elections. And then we've got the deep fake videos coming. Have you guys seen those where they paste somebody else's face on and you can't even tell the difference? I mean, it makes me nervous.
That's going to make people more skeptical. I think that's not as bad. But if you go back, 50 years, 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, people were pushing. In the United States, just like we had politicians believing that the Freemasons are taking over the world without ever having internet, and they were spreading that, and people were believing that. People would, before the internet, people were publishing crap like this on paper before, and even before people could read, people were spreading these stories like through word of mouth. This is how religion even started. Isn't this like,
larger point that, just a few decades ago, Black people didn't have the right to vote. And, right. you know, we just celebrated the anniversary of the women's suffrage movement. That's not very far back in our history. And it was only for essentially white women at the time. Right, you know, right. we've had how many world wars and the deaths of millions of people, and we've had plague and famine and all those other things. You know, Steven Pinker's done a lot of great writing about how we have actually evolved as a society into the most civilized moment in human history.
Right.
But I don't think I'm more speaking about there's a celebration of ignorance and delusion going on in the United States and in parts of the world that I am genuinely scared about.
Okay, but Seth, we have now, okay, so we have the intellectuals right now and we have anti-intellectuals, right? But we have had, we come from a time that the intellectual community considered Black people to be subhuman, right? The academic, the scientific people had a close to consensus that, okay, like these are lower beings that are technically not human. Like this is the world that, and this is not that long time, that's not long ago, right? So I think we, as bad as things are, we have made a lot of progress, right? And maybe we are just one problem with the internet and the media is not just that these bad ideas spread sometimes faster, but I mean the counter is that good ideas are also spreading faster. But things look worse. Sometimes things look worse than they are because not just because the bad information is spreading faster, but because we're also more exposed to this, to bad news, you know, than before. Like, so it might look worse than it actually is because good news doesn't get that much of a, it's not that interesting to people. So that's also about things might be actually a lot better, but we're just consuming a lot more bad news compared to before. So that could be
another. There's some truth to that.
Yeah.
I saw a video yesterday of some anti-maskers at a grocery store who took off their panties and stuck them on their face. And I thought that's,
oh my God, that made it. I was only there for a second.
I thought that's the United States in the year 2020. All right. This is the kind of, I think we're spoiled. I think we're lazy. I think we take our lives and what we enjoy for granted. I think there is a distrust of science and scientists in a hugely critical time. So I'm not saying that we weren't superstitious and barbaric and bigoted and all those things in our past. And I'm acknowledging the fact that all the things that we didn't know about before are now on our Twitter feed 24/7, so much so that it's overwhelming. But there is a celebration of sort of this, my belief is greater than your knowledge, that has been empowered. The QAnon has been empowered. The hate groups have been empowered, and they're using technology to propagate their ideas and often monetize those ideas. This is a layer to the cake that we haven't seen before the internet. And I do have grave concerns that we're going to see the celebration of ignorance take us as a country and as a planet to some very dark places.
It's important to point the celebration of ignorance, but I think it's also important to note the celebration of, the intellectual achievements of, you know, United States. And I think it's becoming a little bit too popular by Americans to, like, a little bit self-flagellate, like, oh my God, sorry, we're so ashamed, please don't hate us. And I think it's okay to do that, but I think it's important to also remember that in the year 2020, United States is still the leading funder of everything scientific. They are still at the front line of fighting disease, not just in the United States, but around the planet, fighting against malaria, fighting against poverty, fighting against starvation. When there's a tragedy anywhere on the planet, the groups, human rights groups, and that are not just in, like, and all the groups that are against poverty, against natural disasters, is always groups from the United States that are the first there to show up with the most amount of funding and the most amount of equipment, with the most amount of resources, and they're usually the last to leave. When it comes to the technology that the entire planet is enjoying, a lot of it for free, technology that is helping a lot of people get out of poverty, like, I don't know, the cell phones that people are using, the internet that people are using, Facebook, Google, and access to the information that people have, the online classrooms that are being, this is all from the U.S. And in the year 2020, this is all still from the U.S. So It's important to remember that and put that in context when you're also pointing out the celebration of ignorance. That you should be pointing, like, it's good to point that out, but let's not lose, like, the bigger picture here, I think.
You lost me at all. But I get your point.
I think I have a little bit of an answer to that. I think that right now, a lot of the U.S., a lot of the people who have actually perpetuated these technologies and all these advances, like the scientific community, the tech community, and all these, and they also tend to largely be liberal, is that they're suffering through a PTSD from 2016, and they don't want to be complacent again. Right, I think they were shot so badly by what happened that they don't want to be complacent and start thinking, okay, things are okay, everything is still better. And so, I think you're absolutely right. I think things are good. And one of the things I said, you know, before, but I want to say for our audience as well, is the optimism, the sense of optimism I got was when I watched the Democratic National Convention, and not because it was Democratic, not even because it was liberal, but because it was actually not any of that. It was the widest coalition of people. You've got Republicans from the Lincoln Project, you've got 4-star military generals, and then on the other extreme, you've got the super sort of progressive, liberal, pro-intersectionality, you know, the trans activists, and everybody is under one umbrella, and they're united against, you know, something that is not political, not, you know, ideological, but it's just a thing about decency. Like, you know, we are people, we disagree. And it made me think, you know, like how we all used to think that the Republicans were evil or this side is evil or the one. It made me think that, okay, it's not all of these people are, they genuinely are decent people who are trying to do the right thing in their own minds, but we all just disagree. But everybody's on one side. And that was phenomenal to me, you know, to see that, you know, John Kasich and, you know, Michael Bloomberg and this guy, Colin Powell, all these sort of conservatives lining up with, you know, really far left progressives and being on the same side against what they thought was just fundamentally indecent and fundamentally just morally objectionable.
You know, except for the obligatory faith talk, which we expect at that level of politics.
You also have a free thought caucus.
Biden gave a humanistic message.
He did, yeah.
And it was refreshing because we have become so numb to Trump's default, which is attack, 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 divide, inflame, and usually redirect the focus back toward himself. To watch Biden stand behind the podium and really speak about inclusivity and kindness and hope and optimism and let's pull together, what can we achieve? You know, that is the language of leadership. And, you know, I have some Trumpers around me who try to tell me that it's not the president's job to make everybody feel warm and fuzzy. His job is to go and to drop bombs on the terrorist and to make us money in the economy and stay out of our lives kind of thing. But I think leadership is more abstract than that. I think people want to be instructed, motivated, and inspired by their leaders. The leaders also are servant, right? Accountable to the people. But people want to be able to look up and be instructed, motivated, and inspired to be brought together. And language has the power to do that. Trump has been really exposed as someone who lacks at his core the ability to speak in the true language of leadership. And this week at the DNC, I saw the language of leadership, inclusivity. Let's come together. Let's overcome our problems. Let's talk to each other. Let's figure it out. Let's keep each other safe. Let's restore our humanity. Man, it was so refreshing. It was like oxygen. And I'm curious to see what the contrast is going to be at the Republican convention if the tone is going to be what I expect it to be, given the last almost 4 years, especially with Donald Trump. So.
I can already hear the progressives, they respond to stuff here saying like, yeah, Trump is bad. Trump bombs innocent people and helps, you know, funds the bombing of innocent people in foreign countries while using crude language. Unlike the Biden and Hillary and Obama who support the bombing of innocent civilians while talking more intellectually and talking like, oh, that is so much better. That is so, like, that's what they would say. But I'm not saying that. But how would you respond to that? Like, they're saying, like, you guys, you, Ali Rizvi and Seth Andrews, you guys are so obsessed with the way people talk rather than policies that actually makes a difference. And to them, they seem to be, you know, we'll just, you know, there's not that much of a difference. Just one of them does it in a polite way and the other one is just more crude and not very PC in the way that they talk. But,
well, let's say that I stood apart with Obama on drone strikes. All right. But against the totality of the man and his presidency, I see someone who has acted almost entirely in a humanistic way, who did not speak in the language, he did not deal in the currency of cruelty and dehumanization and self-aggrandizement. So, you know, I can take fierce opposition to the droning that happened during the Obama administration, et cetera. I know some people are upset about the Iran deal. And I, you know, if you look into that, you realize it was a deal that was put in place decades ago and he was simply fulfilling the deal. But overall, I don't see any similarities between the two. And I do see that leadership means that you are able to go. And I always say, if Trump is us, then shame on us, because he, as our elected leader, is a representative of our ideals and values. And it is the responsibility of a president to be a representative of that. So are we defined by selfishness, self-aggrandizement, cruelty, predatory behavior, even sexually predatory behavior, you know, cheating, lying, just stomping people into oblivion when they get in your way? Is that who we are? Well, Obama doesn't represent that. Biden doesn't represent that for me. And so it makes the choice much easier.
Yeah, just to be clear, I wasn't saying anything like that. I think policy-wise, I'm just letting you know, I can hear some progressives say that.
I don't know. I hear quite a bit of that. I hear it about, you know, that they'll say, what did he accomplish and what has he done and how is he any better? But I just think it's a false equivalency argument. I don't think the history has ever seen anything like what we've seen in the last three and a half years. This is a new deal. We got a reality show host who has no ability to do anything. He does not read. He's not a student of history. He's not a student of the world. He doesn't give a shit. Who is at the point position in the Oval Office, who's throwing 100 tweets and retweets out a day in the middle of a pandemic when he should be doing the job of the presidency. We've never seen anything like this. It's a total anomaly.
He also talks about Law and Order, even though, like, virtually everybody he had is a convicted felon. Most recently now Bannon, Steve Bannon.
Bannon. There's a surprise. What a slimy character that guy is.
And it's just, you know, his lawyer, Michael Cohen. There's like everybody. Well, we know that. Everybody's heard it on all the cable channels. Criminal enterprise. Well,
I think at the end of the day, I hold to, I think that Fox News and the Fox News culture has helped to fuel much of what's happening. And I don't mean that as a positive. They're part of the problem. And I think one of the ways to counter it, to go back to your earlier question, is to introduce the Fox Newsers to different ideas, because they're locked in a conduit. I don't think we walk in and brandish those ideas right off the bat. I think we're going to have to develop personal relationships with people before they will listen to us. Yeah. It's like atheism and religion. You know, Ryan Cragen's a sociologist at the University of Tampa, and he was like, the number one determiner for minds being changed was changing someone's social circle. If I walk into a room and I'm like, I'm an atheist, the Christian, that's the first thing I say. They shut down, they're gone, I never see them again. But if they get to know me as a human being and they like me, and then my atheism comes up in conversation, now I can't fit in a box. Now we're already talking. And when you begin to exchange ideas as human beings, that's when minds are changed. There's an anecdote in the book about a guy who, there's a documentary about him, his daughter produced, where he got locked into the outrage machine, and she essentially sort of, they turned off his right-wing radio shows and turned on some other shows, so he heard other ideas, and he began to sort of open his mind, and before you knew it, he was able to escape the cocoon. So I remain a speech guy. It's an imperfect solution, but I think we know we have to keep engaging the culture in order to be able to see the best ideas win the day.
Yeah.
Ali, we do need to get to the patron. I saw a lot of good questions coming from our patrons, so we do need to get to that. But I just want to, because Roof was asking for something more positive, I did want to mention that every time you see this whole QAnon, Trump supporting crazy conspiracies, just remember, like, if you're American, I'm like, oh my God, I'm so like this. What happened? Just remember that United States is the country that took humanity to the moon. And it's still in year 2020, United States is still the country that is leading the world in science and technology. And it will probably remain there longer if you vote Trump out of office.
Yeah, that is actually precisely why the Trump thing is such a big threat. And, you know, like, I get this all the time. It's like, you're totally, totally focused on Trump, all the stuff I used to do before. And I honestly, I don't think we can have everything that's happening. One of the reasons, you know, we're used to authority. If you have Trump-like figures out in Saudi Arabia or out in North Korea, you know, that's something that we're used to. We don't like it. We always speak against it, but it's something we're used to. But when that happens in a country that actually really a lot of us look to as a, you know, and I'm not, I don't want to sound like nationalistic or anything here, but, you know, as a beacon of, you know, some of the Enlightenment values, but then it becomes a big problem. It's like, you know, if somebody commits a crime or commits a theft, then, you know, you go after them, that's okay. But when it's a judge or when it's somebody who's actually in charge of the law, it becomes a big issue. It's a much more serious problem. The U.S. happens to be more consequential to the world, and that's why it's a problem.
Yeah, actually, Ali makes a very good point, because it's not just science and technology. No country defends free speech and other Enlightenment values as aggressively as the United States does today, and it's a model for the rest of the world. And again, this is another reason why you need to vote Trump out of office, because no. And there's not a greater threat to free speech and Enlightenment values in the United States greater than Trump.
And I want to have these conversations. I want to have, like, you know, you're talking about the woke left, Armin. I do think that there's a problem with cancel culture. I think there is a problem with woke dogmatism. I want to have that conversation, but you can't have, it's like, you know, aliens are attacking the earth, right? When aliens are attacking the earth, you can't sit there and talk about, you know, these minor nuances that, okay, I think that we should
not. No. Okay, Ali, if aliens are attacking the earth, and that I understand, but if you're the army that you're assimilating against the alien attack, if they're using plastic weapons and they're like if they're not, you know, it's for the sake of the alien attack that you need to fix things at home.
Armin, the point I'm making is that you have to kind of come together. It's like minor. I'm not saying that they're minor issues, but the best way to really, Trump, right, has legitimized the opposition, has strengthened the reason that the woke left and all of this leftist dogmatism has become so powerful, the extreme left has become so powerful, is because you have an extreme right authoritarian government. So more people are sympathizing it. They're getting more strength. It's harder to have conversations. We're ex-Muslims. We want to have ex-Muslim conversations. We talk about criticizing Islam and not demonizing Muslims. You talk about that now while Trump is talking about banning all Muslims from the U.S. and he's got Muslim bans and he's got all this other sort of anti-Muslim rhetoric. It becomes harder to have that conversation for ex-Muslims as well. It becomes harder to talk to liberals who are so consumed by this other threat that they have. I want this thing out of the way so we can get back to the conversations that we want.
Me too. It's not an either or, though, Ali. Like, the woke fuels Trump, and Trump fuels the woke. Anyways, we do need to get.
I get the vibe you guys have had a version of this conversation every week that you've been on the air together.
You don't know the least.
Get the vibe that this is territory that you guys are familiar with. Look, I have to disagree on a few things, and I write about this in the book. This country likes to believe it's the greatest, but in almost every major metric, we are not. We're not the most technologically advanced. We don't have the best healthcare. We don't have the best cost of living. We're not the least warlike or the most peaceful. We don't have the largest standing army. We are one of those, what we're good at, we are certainly a powerful and influential nation. But what we're really good at is national pride. In other words, we're number one at saying that we're number one. And so while I do think that we are a mover shaker and tremendously influential and have brought a tremendous amount of good to the world, I also am of the opinion that other free nations around the world, their freedom isn't any worse than my freedom, and that there are wonderful meritorious places that are actually more advanced in a lot of the major metrics than we are here in the United States. And because we are lazy and spoiled here in this country, I worry that what we have that is so good is going to slip through our fingers, and we should not take it for granted. And we must remain advocates for science and humanism in this country. And I think that's my larger point.
But here's the thing, Seth, the things that you said doesn't really contradict what I said, because all of that could be true. I mean, technologically advanced, I don't know why you don't think, I mean, they are the greatest source and funder of technological inventions. That is true. But maybe, I don't know what you mean by that. But all the other things that you mentioned, I agree with. But again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't point to all the negatives. But I think people on both sides sometimes go to the extreme. The people that do want to focus on the positive of the United States completely dismiss all the negatives that you just mentioned. But I also see the problem on the other side. I mean, you just acknowledged a lot of the great things that came out of the United States. But there are a lot of people that do, like, when they want to focus on the negatives from the United States, they do not even acknowledge all the positives that you just you acknowledge. Like, I think that's
You can get sucked into these discussions and they go on for an hour. Like, we could probably talk about this all night. Okay, well, right. I totally take your point.
Let's go to patrons. Since you guys had it, I just want to say one sort of example about why I think it's complicated. And I actually agree with you, Seth. I agree with Armin too on this. So I'm playing equivocator here. But for example, you said that the U.S. doesn't have the best healthcare system. Actually, the U.S. does have the best healthcare system, but it has the best healthcare in terms of quality, but it doesn't have the best system to get everybody access to it. So that's where it becomes complex. You know, you have a lot of amazing things to offer, but the kind of system that you have doesn't give everybody access to it. So that's just one example of how there is a bit of an imbalance. So I'm with you on that. So you want to go on to patron questions? You have one more?
I highlighted this one by Ruth.
Okay, so Ruth Creations is saying, if their brains are different, she's talking about conservatives and liberals, if their brains are different, is there hope for crossing that divide? I'm getting so frustrated right now with the conversations I'm having.
Well, I'm not a fan of spinning your wheels. It's like talking to a religious person. You know, I think it's important to have that conversation, to present contradictory ideas, to challenge each other in goodwill and good faith, blah, blah, blah. But I understand the frustration. And I think if you determine that you're going to change their mind, I don't do this with religion. I don't do it with politics. My job is to present a differing point of view, and then to analyze and try to see the best ideas win. But if they double down, if the backfire effect kicks in, the wall goes up and it's not productive, I don't spend too much more time on it. I will give you a little bit of hope, though. I'm a guy who used to be that guy. I was a Fox News evangelical, right-wing, Bible literalist, fundamentalist Christian. And I was reasoned out of my unreasonable faith. So while it doesn't happen nearly often enough, it does happen. and people's lives are improved and changed, and I'm living proof of that.
Okay, so the next question is from Matt Rose. He's saying, what do you think of Brett Weinstein's Unity 2020? Are you familiar with
it? I don't really know much about it. I mean, what is it?
I actually just looked it up. I didn't know about it either.
Yeah, I actually seen people keep bringing it up. I have to look into that as well. It seems like it's becoming more popular, so I don't know what it is.
So I'm seeing something from Jay Shapiro, who commented on it. So Brett Weinstein, who is the evolutionary biologist. He is, I think it's a third party. It looks like a third party thing. He wants Unity 2020 to be like a third party type entity. They have identified six candidates for a presidential ticket, like Andrew Yang, Jesse Ventura, Dan Crenshaw, Tulsi
Gabbard. Whoa, hang on, hold on, hang on.
Yeah.
Andrew Yang and Jesse Ventura?
I don't know if this is with consent.
This might not be a good representation of what they're saying, though, so I don't know.
Well, no, this is actually from them. Six potential candidates. But I don't think they got consent from the candidates. but they have presidential.
Let's see Seth's fair sake. He seems to be interested in that because based on what he just heard.
I doubt Andrew Yang's name.
Hold on.
Unity
Yang Ventura 2020. Sunday. Yeah.
74 days before the election. So what is your opinion of Unity 2020 third party? I have a feeling I know where this is going to go.
Well, sorry. I mean, I think at this late stage in the game, it's a two-horse race, like it or hate it. I just think right now we're stopping the arterial spray that is the Trump administration. So I like Yang. I think that guy's crazy smart.
He's great.
And I'd love to see him, maybe the groundwork is being laid now for real, advances in his political career and influence in the years to come. That guy excites me, but I think right now it's a two-horse race and we got to focus where we focus. So
yeah, and Yang, for everybody knows, just so we're not misinforming anybody, Yang has endorsed Biden, and he did it very vocally at the convention as well. So I don't think he himself is down with this Unity 2020 thing, but let's go on. Ruth Lucy is asking, would fundamentalist Christians also see any mocking or attacking of Trump as proof of his special place given by God?
Yeah, I think it's tough. It's like if you have a total asshole in your family and you know they're an asshole, you can say they're an asshole. But if somebody else calls them that, you rally to defend your family member, because he's in your group. He's part of your tribe. Mm-hmm. I can criticize him, but you can't do that. And that's one downside to the mockery, that it in many ways, I think, for some people, causes them to rush to defend. But I also, and this is hard, I find that sometimes the ridiculous is deserving of ridicule. If you have someone who takes himself so monumentally seriously, and he thinks he is all of these amazing and wonderful things, there is utility in flying the baby diaper Trump blimp over London. You know what I'm saying? I mean, mockery does have some utility there. And that, the Trumpers may rush to defend him, but I don't know. I tend to lean more on the mock side. I don't know if it's right or wrong. Do you guys think, do you have an opinion on that? Like he's just so ripe for parody,
I think the more he gets attacked, the more persecuted he is, and that makes him more of a hero in his followers' eyes. It's basically like what you said. It's a cult or a religion. I mean, that's what gives him oxygen. Like his whole thing is, look, everybody's attacking me. I mean, Bernie Sanders, kind of similar thing, very different man, different person. But, the media is going to try to bring me down. The intelligence agencies are bringing me down. The judges are against me. Everybody's against me. My own FBI and CIA are trying to bring me down. Obama spied on me. Like all of this stuff. There's anger. The system is rigged. The election is rigged. I mean, this is the kind of stuff when you hear it. You're basically peddling persecution. You're a persecution junkie, and that's it's very sort of Jesus-like in one. That's one way in which he's used a slight bias. Matt Rose is asking, to Seth Andrews, well, obviously to Seth Andrews, what's your view on the Black Lives Matter movement?
Matt, your avatar freaks me out. I'm just saying. Freaks me out. It's going to keep me up at night. I like it. I know they're opponents of identity politics, but I am totally down with the idea of identifying a marginalized group and examining how and why they have been marginalized and trying to draw attention to that to help rectify a problem. I'm not saying that everybody who waves the BLM flag is a good person, blah, blah, blah. But I think the movement itself is a wonderful and necessary idea, and I totally support it. Somebody had they said it this way, you know, whenever somebody used to go out and say, save the whales, you know, a conservationist says, save the whales. You don't see other people going, well, all fish matter. Well, actually, it was the whales that were being hunted down. This was where the problem had to be focused. And so if we're seeing a disproportionate amount of dehumanization, violence, et cetera, carried out against a specific demographic, I think it's just fine to draw a big red flashing circle around that demographic and saying, this is a problem. Their lives aren't worth more. I think it was it Biden who said it? Or was it Kamala Harris who said it? Their lives aren't worth more or less. They're worth, but they're worthy. They have value. So I support Black Lives Matter in that way.
How would you respond to two counterpoints to that? Some people say, listen, I support Black Lives Matter lowercase as a movement. But the organization, the Black Lives Matter uppercase, I've looked into them specifically, and they do not seem to be pushing for the things that people seem to be thinking that they're pushing for. But most people who do say Black Lives Matter and protesting, they seem to be pushing for the things I want. But this organization, this institution, and the founders of it, I'm not necessarily behind supporting them. So Black Lives Matter lowercase, yeah, I'm on board with that. But Black Lives Matter as an institution, as an organization, I'm not into supporting it. What do you say? That's the first one. What do you say to that?
Well, some people, I think it comes down to a difference of philosophy. The founders of Black Lives Matter have Marxist leanings and have their anti-capitalist sentiments at play, because obviously if we live in a capitalist society that has been really dominated by white males until just a few decades ago, then they have seen that Black people have been marginalized by the system itself. And I think systemic racism is real. I think that they have been locked out by the specific system. Now, I'm not anti-capitalist, but I'm saying that I understand where those sentiments come from. And the idea that they are using Black Lives Matter to attack the system itself. I mean, you can make that position, but most of the messaging I've seen that comes out of Black Lives Matter at every level is simply that: Black Lives Matter. And so lowercase, uppercase, I haven't seen anything that's caused me personal pause or injury. I think, you know, the message itself at both levels remains a worthy one. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I mean, I could push back against that, but I want to go to the second and maybe actually the third one as well. What do you say to people who say that even the broader movement, not talking about the people in the organization, seem to be ignoring the place that the Black lives are being taken the most, right? Like if Black lives matter, why there's this strong avoidance of talking about the main source of Black people dying from violence, which is Black on Black crime? I understand that police brutality is a thing that needs to be addressed, but if you genuinely care about Black lives, the number of Black people that are being killed from Black on Black violence seems to be a lot more. And again, this is not a suggestion that this is something innate within Black people. This is because of socioeconomic factors and all that, and because of discrimination and blah, 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 and everything. Yeah, all that, given that all of that being the case, why is it that none of these Black Lives movements seem to be wanting to address that as a issue? It seems like there's an agenda rather than genuinely caring about Black lives. What would you say to that?
Well, I'm not a social scientist. I think there is an agenda. And I think the focus right now is, especially in the wake of George Floyd and those like him over the course of decades, the overreach of police power, deadly force used disproportionately against Black people. And I think that's where the conversation is focused right now. I don't think that I'm hearing that the other conversations don't matter or that they shouldn't be taken into account.
They're not saying it doesn't matter. They're not saying it doesn't matter, but they don't seem to be wanting to touch it at all either. Like maybe their organization's name should not be Black. Maybe the movement should not be Black Lives Matter. Maybe it should be called We're Against Police Brutality, something against police brutality against Black people. Because if you want to pretend that you're against Black, if you were to pretend that you're for Black lives, you can't, it's not enough for you to just be like, oh yeah, you could go focus on that. No, you should be focusing on that if you're saying Black Lives Matter.
I think it's injustice in all of its forms based on race is certainly something that should be part of the conversation. At this moment, because it is on the tip of everyone's tongue and because we're talking about people who are given lethal force and the quote-unquote authority to dispense that force as servants of the communities, I think right now their focus being on the systems and the law enforcement officers themselves. I don't begrudge them using the term Black Lives Matter in that way. And if this is the first step of many, then I think that's a good thing. Okay. I don't have a catch-all solution, but I do think that right now the conversation is about the institutions of law enforcement, and I have no problem if they want to focus there for the moment until that problem is addressed, and then we can move on to the rest.
Yeah.
I do have some other points that I wish I could bring up, but Ali wants to move on.
We don't have a lot of time. We've taken a lot of time, Seth.
But I do want to highlight this question, but one of our patrons already answered that. I just wanted to recommend people. So Ruth is asking, is there another episode where Seth shares his coming out to atheism story? And Lewis already answered that. Seth's first book is Deconverted. Ali, can you, this is just a patron version, but in the public version where the audio comes out, can you give me the link to both, not just this book, but also Deconvert? So guys, if you want to, it's actually a very interesting, fascinating story.
There's also a YouTube speech that I gave that chronicles my story. I did it in Minneapolis a couple of years ago. It's Seth Andrews from Religion to Reason.
Seth, I was trying to get you to sell more books, but now you offered.
I'm a shitty businessman. I'm a terrible businessman.
But I got it. I mean, the important thing that gets out there, and I want to tell everybody, while never forget Deconverted, is because the way that I read Deconverted, the first time when I learned about it, is because Seth, you and I, both of our books had the same subtitle. Yeah. So Seth's book is called Deconverted, A Journey from Religion to Reason, and my book is called The Atheist Muslim, A Journey from Religion to Reason. And, you know, I guess great minds think alike. That's what it is.
It was this weird serendipitous convergence that happened there, and I love it. I love the fact that if somebody Googles our subtitles, that they'll see us both. We are brothers in that way. So we're bonded.
So Matt is asking, how would Seth respond to Ayan's fears of Biden secretly bringing Sharia to America? I don't know if you follow the story, if you're aware of it.
Yeah. Really. Well, I'm a fan of Ayan Hirsi Ali. The book Infidel was tremendously inspiring. I so appreciate her work for women's rights all around the world. Having said that, what the fuck is she talking about?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, what? I did not. I saw the Biden comments. I saw the context. I'm not making the connection that she made. I certainly don't see any sort of promotion or seeding of Sharia law into the United States. Am I missing something, guys? Yep. Am I missing something?
No. Yeah. We pointed out that this was there are some legitimate concerns, I think, but I think Ayan, this exaggeration, it's very similar, Seth, it's very similar to the problems I have with the woke cult. like racism and transphobia and homophobia and misogyny, these are real issues. And it's harder, it's really hard for us to actually address these issues when some people go and exaggerate and see things and they find it where it doesn't exist. It's like these problems, when we attack the woke cult, it doesn't mean that these are not real problems that need to be addressed. The woke cult is distracting us from actually addressing these problems. So the same thing is very similar to Ian Hirsi Ali's comment. I think the influence of Islam is a big deal in politics, and we need to fight back against it. But the same people won't ever admit that the influence of Christianity in U.S. politics is a lot bigger and a lot more harmful right now than Islam would ever become. They would never call that out because they're just so focused on Islam. I always tell people Islam is not a major threat in the United States. Islam is a major threat in Islamic countries. But I was critical of what Biden, you know, mentioning that hadith. I was like, this is a very problematic hadith. You don't know what this means. You don't know what it promotes. And you shouldn't be reciting scripture anyways, whether it's Islamic or Christian, right? You're running for president, God damn it, right? So I wanted to call that out as bullshit. But when Ian comes at it like, oh, he's enforcing Sharia law. Like, no, he's not. He's not. What the fuck are you talking about? He's not. Like, great. Now, like, I can't even address this issue that Biden is doing something because now I have to address your bullshit because now people would dismiss the fact that he's even, that this is an issue because you go like, oh yeah, you're like fear mongering, like Ian Hirsi Ali. Like, yeah, you're right. I have to actually address, Ian is doing something more dangerous than even Biden was doing. So I have to address that instead.
This is the point. This is what I was trying to say about how, you know, the reason I want all of this stuff just out of the way is so we can have these conversations again, normally, yeah, the way that we need to prioritize.
Well, it's not going to go out of the way, but it's going to help. I agree with that.
No, it is going to, yeah, because at least, once you have like something like this in power, then we can talk about all of these other issues, you know? But anyway, Seth, I want to put, yeah, okay, there you go. I was going to tell you the highlight, the last comment. We're going to close with that. Mars is saying Seth's voice is the closest thing you'll hear to the voice of God. And you hear that all the time. There's a reason that you were a Christian talk radio host. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners actually were very, very tempted and maybe have given into that. You probably caused a lot of sin. People listening to your voice,
whatever. No, I kind of came into the movement at a time when we kind of needed storytellers, you know, to come from a communication background, and everybody's been really kind and generous, and yeah, you know, it's all I got. It's what I do. I flap my gums. I tell stories. I try to remind people they're not alone. It's okay, you know, and that we're all in this together, and you know, I figure let's just keep on keeping on. But I appreciate you guys letting me come and play along. It's always a pleasure to hang with you, my brother.
It's an honor, and I really mean it. You've seen me effusively. I've been reading your book, and again, I'm not totally through it, but I do think that it's the best thing that you've written.
Thank you, and it's
incredibly relevant for, you know, what we're doing right now.
Well, I'm doing signed copies if anybody wants some. I mean, you can go to Amazon if you want. I'm waiting on the audiobook any minute. I mean, it could be now. It could be 2 weeks from now. Audible's killing me. But you can go to SethAndrews.com, and right there on the homepage is everything you'd need. So if you want an autographed copy, I'll sign one and send it to you. If you want just to get it off Amazon, that link is there. Just go to SethAndrews.com.
Thank you very much. The link's going to be in the description.
Yeah. Get the signed copy, guys. Get the signed copy. Link. Make sure. Yeah. Let's link to that instead of Amazon for the signed copy.
Okay. There you go. That's perfect.
All right, guys.
Thank you for coming on. Really, really appreciate it. I think it's great. I hope you go out and you talk to loads more people, and I hope that everybody reads your book.
Seriously. Very kind. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thanks.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.